Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me for the roundtable this week, we have Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hello. Happy Monday.
And Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Andrew.
It's good to be here.
In a few minutes, we'll also hear from Morgan Trow, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. She is in Akron awaiting the verdict in the First Energy trial, so we'll get an update from her in just a few minutes. But first, I wanted to talk about intoxicating hemp. A new law went into effect on Friday. There was a last-minute dash to get a referendum on the ballot, but that fizzled out. And then there was a try at a temporary injunction, but no injunction came from the Franklin County courts. So House Speaker Matt Huffman told reporters last week he did not expect the referendum to succeed. Here's what he said to Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
I don't think it was viable from a financial standpoint for them to referend that bill. And I think they've realized that.
So, Sarah, what about Huffman's comments there? So they were trying to put something on the ballot to stop the law from going into effect. But was it timing? Would they just didn't have enough signatures?
Yeah, a spokesperson for Ohioans for Cannabis Choice, that's the campaign effort that was trying to get the referendum on the ballot. They said they just were working on a truncated timeline and they weren't able to get the number of signatures. And getting a repeal effort on the ballot is notoriously challenging. You have to get, I think, based on the most recent election numbers, you have to get more than 248,000 valid signatures to land a repeal on the ballot. And this group in particular, the law passed in December. So they announced like that day that they were going to be collecting signatures. Well, when they went to Attorney General Dave Yost the first time and submitted their petition was rejected. So that set off another clock where they had to resubmit. And then Yost had so many days to check their petition again. So by the time that they were actually able to start collecting signatures, I want to say it was February. I mean, they really only had several weeks to get all of these signatures.
Were they close?
Would not say. I asked their spokesperson how many signatures they collected, and they wouldn't say. So it's tough to say. I mean,
there's a difference between being 500 away and like, 50,000
well,
away.
I think it's important to note that if they were that close, I imagine they would have submitted. If you look at like the most recent effort at a repeal that was on Senate Bill 1, the overhaul of the higher education law that went into effect last year, there were some professors who tried to get a repeal of that law on the ballot. They came up short, and I think they had like high 100,000. So it's like, if you're really close, there's a cure period and all of that. So I imagine they just made the calculation that it was just not worth it to submit based on the number of signatures they had.
All right. So, Andrew, they also tried to file a lawsuit, and nothing really happened with that.
Yeah, actually, they tried to file two lawsuits. One was in Franklin County, and the other one was with the Ohio Supreme Court. And what I mean, it's not a coincidence because the deadline was there for the law to take effect. That also is why it also served as a deadline for the signatures to get turned in. And so right as the law was going to take effect, both judges, basically, the Franklin County judge declined to issue an injunction, which would have blocked it temporarily while the case played out. And the Ohio Supreme Court just dismissed the lawsuit completely without really explaining themselves. There was a note from Chief Justice Sharon Kennedy that she wouldn't have voted to dismiss the lawsuit, but the majority didn't kind of give their opinion about why they did that.
Okay, so right now, as of Friday, businesses cannot sell intoxicating hemp products, certain beverages that have THC in them. Am I correct here?
Yeah, that's correct. And I saw on Thursday, which was at this point, the repeal campaign had announced that it had failed. You saw local businesses having like buy three, get one free, just trying to liquidate their inventory. So I actually haven't done any reporting on exactly what these businesses are going to do with these products that they have and they now can't sell in Ohio. I don't know if they're going to try to, if it's possible, to get them into the state dispensaries. I don't know if they're going to try to shift them to other states. But it's an interesting question because in the paperwork in their lawsuits, there's the plaintiffs for the Supreme Court case, at least that I saw, included a brewery called 50 West Brewing and a national company based in Portland that's selling these products. And they're talking about, you know, the national company said they were selling like maybe more than $1 million of these a year in Ohio. The breweries said that they had hundreds of thousands of dollars of inventory. So that was it was interesting to kind of see some of those numbers show up in those filings. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what they do with them because I actually haven't looked into it yet.
And it's important to note that lawmakers wanted to have those THC beverages still have some latitude here, but the governor shut that down. He did a line item veto, right?
Yeah, and that was kind of the premise of the Supreme Court case that went nowhere. These breweries and beverage businesses felt that Governor DeWine's line item veto was not really in the spirit of the line item veto. You know, of course, that case got dismissed. But it's interesting because it's not just that these breweries can't sell their products in Ohio. If you think about a brewery like 50 West, like they sell their products like in Kentucky, too. Mm. So they also can't produce the products in Ohio and sell them in other states. But lawmakers did want to carve beverages out. I mean, I've been following, and I know Andrew has too, these efforts at regulation since marijuana was legalized in 2023. And this has been a long haul and a winding road, of course, because the federal government issued a ban on hemp like right before this bill passed that kind of threw a wrench in what lawmakers were looking at doing. But I think that lawmakers kind of looked at it as three different buckets of products: legal marijuana, which is being sold in licensed dispensaries, and then these hemp gummies and the things that are being sold at gas stations and holistic wellness stores, and then these beverages, these drinkable THC and CBD beverages that are being sold at breweries and gas stations and all of that. So it's this third category. It's going to be interesting to see if down the line lawmakers try to shift the law again, but right now they're illegal.
And one group that is applauding the implementation of this law is the Ohio Cannabis Coalition. That coalition had several reasons for wanting this law in place, mainly the competition, right, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be the clearest example of why they would care about this. But when you actually talk to them, I mean, there are policy arguments they make, which include even claiming that quote-unquote intoxicating hemp that's being sold, they say it's actually just marijuana from other states, and they just kind of call it hemp so they could sell it outside of the dispensaries. Mm-hmm. So this whole area was pretty unregulated, you know, kind of as evidenced by, it seems like overnight that these drinks popped up everywhere, you know, like not just, you know, I'm kind of used to in Ohio, kind of like the gas stations always selling these sort of weird products. Like I remember bath salts from like the 2010s, if anybody remembers that, for example, but actually seeing more, I guess I'd just call them like legitimate businesses selling products with, you know, kind of commercial, professional looking marketing and stuff like that is just really interesting to see. How it all popped up, and now it's gone.
And do you think that some of these places that are selling marijuana legally, will they start selling hemp products? Can they?
So right now, I think, see, the regulatory framework changed so many times because at one point the idea was that they were going to just bring these products behind or into dispensaries. But yeah. I've asked dispensaries, and this was a while back, it didn't seem like the plan was to sell.
They want to just sell
products.
They want to sell the
products that they have. Yeah. And, you know, especially with the drinkables, like that's something that people who drink them say, well, I like getting it at a bar because I don't really like alcohol. So I don't really know what the, like to go into a dispensary to get a six pack of THC seltzers. I mean, maybe people who really, really like them will do it, but that's not really what dispensaries are offering right now, and I don't see them, like, significantly changing their product offerings.
And then the last thing to bring up about this is there is the federal issue where all these products were supposed to be banned federally, so it was Ohio's just ahead of the curve. Is that what's happening now?
Yeah, basically. The original law that would have allowed the drinks to basically be legally sold through the end of the year, and I think the thinking behind that for the backers of keeping these drinks around was that they thought that there'd be successful federal lobbying to eliminate the federal ban. That's basically, it was passed several years ago, and it's, you know, set to take effect after the election in November. Actually, I'm sorry, maybe it's last year that was passed. But yeah, so it is quite possible that Congress will move to allow these things to continue to exist. I mean, I remember during the debate over this bill, Ohio Senate President Rob McCauley just kind of observed that his friends drink these things. And if you know, he's, you know, we're here in Columbus, I guess, and so it's kind of more of a liberal area. But Rob McCauley's from kind of the rural area outside of Toledo. So I think there is widespread adoption of these things. There's a lot of money behind them. You know, I certainly would expect them to have a vigorous lobbying effort federally, but I guess we'll have to see where that one goes.
Okay, so Rob McCauley's friends are mad at him then for passing this?
They could be. I hope he's all right.
We should check on that. Yeah, all right. you're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, and we're talking with Sarah Donaldson of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. And joining us now by phone is Morgan Trowles, Statehouse reporter for News 5 Cleveland. She is in Akron right now awaiting a verdict for the first energy trial. A jury continues to deliberate in the six-week trial of former First Energy executives Chuck Jones and Michael Dowling. Morgan, welcome to All Sides. Thanks for joining us from being on the road.
Of course. Good morning. Thanks for having me from Akron.
Yeah. So so they stand accused in the biggest bribery scandal in Ohio history, paying $4.3 million to former Public Utilities of Ohio chair Sam Randazzo. He died by suicide in April of 2024. The defense in its case pinned the crime on Randazzo, saying he stole money that First Energy intended for its clients. So, Morgan, the jury heard 6 weeks of testimony, much of it very complicated. What are you thinking the jurors are thinking about right now, still having their deliberations?
Yeah, so they've actually, they're on their fourth full day of deliberations right now, and they really have been pretty quiet. They've asked one question so far, which was about a technicality argument. One of the arguments that one of the attorneys for the defense has made is that former CEO Chuck Jones and former SVP Mike Dowling did not actually commit bribery, because you can only bribe somebody who is either a candidate or who is appointed to a position and somebody who is in public office. So they are arguing this technicality of, well, he wasn't officially a candidate yet, so we couldn't have bribed him, because the only way bribes can happen is if it's somebody who is official. And so the jury asked a question basically saying, are you sure about that? Is that what the law is? Does the law say that a public servant can only be bribed when they're a candidate or after the fact? And the defense says yes, but the prosecution said that's absolutely not what Ohio law is. And it doesn't matter if somebody is talking with the governor and they're saying they're part of these internal discussions, it still counts as a bribe.
So the jury did hear 6 weeks worth of testimony, and the thing that a lot of people were waiting for was hearing from former Lieutenant Governor John Husted. He's now our U.S. Senator. He took the stand remotely, so he was still in D.C., and he was kind of, I guess, basically on a Zoom call. Was that testimony, you know, worth the whole wait? We've been waiting for it for a long time.
Probably not. It was rather unremarkable. Really, he didn't remember a lot from it. He said he didn't recall a lot. He also did say, though, that he was not there to speak in defense of Jones and Dowling. So that was one of the more interesting aspects. But other than that, it really was rather unremarkable and kind of a big nothing when it comes to it.
In defense of Senator Husted, though, they were asking him about specific details about a dinner from December of 2018. And I joked on the roundtable last week that I don't remember what I had for dinner last Tuesday. So,
No, 100%. It's very plausible to not remember exact conversations like that. It's more of a, if they were going to have him come on, they asked him about a lot of different events that happened a long, long time ago. Some of them make sense for him not to remember. Some of them are pretty important, and you would wonder how he wouldn't remember. But, you know, he has the right to say that. And if that's his recollection, that's his recollection.
And Morgan, can you remind our listeners of why this case is so important? I mean, how does it basically relate back to everyday Ohioans? Why should they care about whether these executives are found innocent or guilty?
Yeah, of course. So this is This is part of the largest bribery scheme in state history. And so why this is important is because this bill House Bill 6 raised your energy prices. These CEOs and these executives were able to allegedly bribe public officials to raise your bills. And that impacted millions of Ohioans. And so when we're looking at the state of energy prices, especially right now when people are really struggling, it's important to remember that the power that people have over energy policy and over money and over prices. So what the prosecution is arguing is that these men helped do the largest bribery scheme in state history that raised your prices all to benefit their stock prices and to benefit them so that they could buy homes in Naples, Florida.
Morgan, have you been up there covering it for most of the 6 weeks, or have you been like in and out?
I've been in and out. I've definitely been covering it because, luckily, because there's so much interest in this trial, the judge allowed it over Zoom. So I've been watching the Zooms every day, but I've been up here for all the jury deliberations and closings.
And I mean, I know it's just a betting game, but the jury sat for a 6 week trial and now they're in their fourth day of deliberations. I mean, are we expecting a verdict soon, or could they deliberate longer?
You know, I wrote about this in my story last week. You know, I looked at previous corruption trials and how long they lasted. And honestly, we're on kind of the longer side right now. For the amount of charges that they have, it is definitely getting to the point where we should be seeing a verdict. I hope that we get one today, but they're taking a break for tomorrow. And then if we don't get one today, we will return Wednesday.
And there's more than one charge. This is not just an innocent, you know, each guy, whether he's guilty or innocent. There's several charges here.
So there are, Dowling is facing seven charges, ranging from bribery, corrupt activity, telecommunications fraud, all felonies. He's facing seven. And then Jones is facing four charges, also corrupt activity, bribery, conspiracy, and telecommunications fraud.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us from up there and up in Akron. And I hope that I hope you get a verdict soon. And thank you so much for joining us today, Morgan.
Of course. I'll keep you posted.
And you've been listening to Morgan Trowell, State House reporter for News 5 Cleveland. She is in Akron awaiting a verdict in the first energy trial. And this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And coming up, we're going to talk about a $33 billion natural gas plant that was announced in southern Ohio. That's when our Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Sarah, you spent Friday in Piketon, and there were two federal government agencies announcing a $33.3 billion natural gas plant coming to southern Ohio. SB Energy is a subsidiary of the Tokyo-based SoftBank Group, which will lead the project on land where the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant was. So tell us what is taking shape here, and I guess we'll start with why Piketon?
Yeah, so this is born out of what the Trump administration says is a massive trade deal between Japan and the United States. Japan wanted its tariffs lowered, and of course there's been a lot of debate over Trump's tariffs and the legality of them, but to get their tariffs lowered, Japan said it would invest hundreds of billions of dollars in things that are important to America. So One of those things is that America catches up in the AI arms race. That's how folks in Piketon were putting it. So there's all this land down in Piketon where the United States used to enrich uranium. That plot of land, and it's a big plot of land, has been in cleanup mode for more than a decade. So they've been, you know, demolishing the enrichment facilities, which is a lot more than just like taking the buildings down, because obviously there were a lot of toxic materials used to enrich uranium. So they're going to knock these buildings down, and the federal government says that SoftBank's going to come in and build both a 9.2 gigawatt natural gas plant and a 10 gigawatt data center. So I am still learning so many things as I cover data centers, and I've been covering data centers for a couple years, but all I can say is that's really, really, really big.
Really big.
If it comes to fruition, this would be allegedly, and these claims are made a lot, but 10 gigawatts would be the biggest data center in the world. So we'll see. Again,
is it to help build the chips eventually, or like
it's to power artificial intelligence.
Okay.
So the
natural gas plant is to power this
exactly.
Data center. Okay.
So the first phase of the project is to build the data center. They're going to build the data center, and they're not going to build it at full capacity. I think they're going to go with 800 megawatts to start, and then part of the reason that SoftBank landed on this land in Piketon is because there is a ton of energy infrastructure already built in because the enrichment facilities used to be there. So there is a power generator like on a hill that will be feeding energy to the data center to start. You know, the details are a little sparse right now. You know, it's definitely really interesting because this is being built on federal government land that at one time, based on, you know, what I've read and some reporting I've seen from one of our fellow public media stations, WOUB down in Athens, at one time the federal government was going to clean up the land and then turn it over to Pike County. But now the federal government is going to hold on to that land, and you know, you've got other companies down there. Like, there's a company called Centrus Energy, and they are actually enriching uranium on a small plot of land on that federal government land, but they're a private company and they're paying taxes, is my understanding. But if this comes in, like, there's a chance that the local government won't get any tax revenue from it. But, you know, the federal government says that SB Energy is investing all this money. It's going to create, these are the numbers I was given, to start 4,000 construction jobs and 300 to 400 operational jobs, and at full build out, 35,000 construction jobs and 2,500 operational jobs, which is massive for a rural county like that.
Okay, so thousands of jobs to build it. But then once it's built, even though it'll take years to build, is it one of these places that only needs like a dozen people to run it?
So they say it'll take 300 to 400 operational jobs in phase one and 2,500 operational jobs at full build out. So
that's more than a lot of other.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, it's interesting because this represents more broadly an idea. I think lawmakers across the aisle are trying to figure out what to do with data centers. And the trend has long been that these buildings are being built on farmland because it's cheap. But, you know, I've heard from folks like Speaker Matt Huffman, and, you know, I know the Trump administration signed this like pledge a couple of weeks ago, that there's this idea that maybe we build data centers on former brownfields or former industrial land because it's already got some of that infrastructure in place. And also that if these data centers are coming in, and you've heard this desire from both folks on the ground and also lawmakers, they should be generating their own energy. And that is what this right now plan represents. And, you know, the CEO of SoftBank, Masayoshi Son, he was in Piketon and he said, like, I pledge, like, right now, we're not going to raise your energy bills. So
they have to build the natural gas plant, though.
They have to build the natural gas, the really, really, really big natural gas plant to, you know, of course,
to meet
power
that,
the data center. And it's interesting because the last thing I'll say is this you know, there were state lawmakers there. You know, State Senator Shane Wilkins spoke. And I know federal representatives like Senator Bernie Moreno, Senator John Houston were supposed to be there. But the state did not have any insight into this contract. This is a contract between the United States and Japan. And SoftBank was chosen as the company that was going to go in and do this project. But like, you know, it's going to be happening in Ohio, but Ohio really doesn't have oversight into
it. Okay, so
it.
It's not like Governor DeWine was there with a shovel in hand for groundbreaking.
No, Governor DeWine was not handed a shovel. There were state lawmakers who had shovels and, you know, shoveled dirt in the traditional way, but it was, you know, Secretary Howard Lutnick, the Energy Secretary as well. So it was like the U.S. Departments of Energy and Commerce that are really spearheading this project.
There's been increasing pushback around Ohio and around all of the United States against data centers. And your colleague, Karen Kassler, talked with Dana Kinhalt, leader of a group called Adams County for Responsible Development. And the group turned in a petition to the Ohio Attorney General's office for a ban on a specific class of data center. Do you know about this ban, what they're hoping to ban? And is this the type that they want to ban, the Spikeston one?
Well, this is a really big data center. And I think ideally at their core, they want to ban really big data centers. But, you know, there are obviously a lot of hurdles to getting on the ballot. And as much as lawmakers are starting to talk about data centers and you hear it from, you know, state lawmakers, Governor DeWine and, you know, Senator John Houston have been very supportive of the expansion of data centers in Ohio. So it'll be interesting to see how far this goes, because they argue that although there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of things that people point out as negatives. We need data centers for our current, the way that we use the internet and the way that we interact with the internet. You know, if you want to keep using ChatGPT, and I personally don't use chat, like I'm really not like super up on AI, but that's how it's powered. So, yeah. And there's a whole question here too of utilities. I mean, the Ohio Manufacturers Association has argued, you know, there's been this whole battle with AEP and AEP putting these tariffs on data centers, but then the Ohio Manufacturers Association is arguing that AEP is saying that there's more demand than there actually is. So there's a lot going on and a lot of big you know, I think people are trying to find who to blame for, again, at its core, why are energy bills rising?
Yeah, here's Dana Kinhalt just talking a little bit about how there's very little details. There's non-disclosure agreements related to these centers. And here's a little bit of what she had to say.
Once the facility's up and running, it's max like 50 jobs. And they're coming in wanting these huge tax breaks. And I just, besides the temporary construction jobs, I don't really see any benefit for us.
So, yeah, so she's there talking about the tax breaks. And so that's what you were saying, is that this is a federal thing and that Piketon might not see any money from it, but they'll see thousands of construction jobs and then hundreds of jobs running it once it opens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the question every time a data center comes to town. But of course, like I said, the people in power who are defending these things, it's not just Governor DeWine and Senator John Houston. You've seen Democrats like Minority Leader Dani Isaacson say, well, you know, since when were construction jobs not real jobs? And the labor unions have been really supportive because they are providing a ton of construction jobs. So, you know, there are a lot of complicating factors with this issue.
You're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and you've been listening about natural gas plants and data centers with Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We also have with us Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio. And Andrew, I wanted to turn to another thing that happened last week. Ohioans comfortably passed a reproductive rights amendment back in 2023. And now state Republicans are working to put new restrictions in place. And a House committee last week advanced a bill to restore the 24-hour waiting period for an abortion, even though it's currently blocked in court. So House Speaker Matt Huffman said it'll go to the full House maybe even as soon as this week. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Wednesday, the legislature is going to have what's their last scheduled session before they break for spring. So if it happens, it would be on Wednesday.
So how can they vote for to restore the 24-hour waiting period if that element is in the courts right now?
So specifically, the law that is held up in court right now required that someone before getting an abortion would have to visit their doctor's office at least 24 hours in advance first to be given some information about what the law describes as kind of like the risks of abortion. And just to some degree, it's kind of checking a box, making sure that I think the law is intended to make sure people just think about it a little bit first, I guess. And so what's different about this new bill that's being considered would be rather than having to visit the doctor's office, somebody could just do a telehealth visit. The judge in kind of they temporarily blocked the law, the old law, while still kind of like signaling they're likely to strike it down completely. But one of the factors they cited in their decision doing that was the burden that it would place on somebody to have to travel to a doctor's office 24 hours before. And it could be more than that. Sometimes people have to travel out of state. They might, in a more rural area, you know, they might not have transportation. There might be kind of just, there's just burdens associated with that. So the sponsors of this bill and the backers of it say, well, if that's a burden, this isn't a burden because anybody can just do a virtual telehealth visit. So it's meant to address part of the judge's concern, although the judge's broader concern was the fact that the amendment that voters approved in 2023 had language. It's very sweeping and says, you know, I don't have it in front of me, but basically says the state shall not burden anybody either.
Yeah, from... here I have it.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. So it says no law shall, quote, directly or indirectly burden, penalize, prohibit, or interfere with the right to make one's own reproductive decisions.
And so directly or indirectly burden, are you indirectly burdening somebody by having them have to go through a virtual doctor's appointment? You know, so we'll sort of see how this one actually plays out. But it's just there have been several bills that House Republicans have pursued that get at the issue of abortion since this amendment got approved by voters. But this is, I would say, the most direct actual restriction that Republicans now are trying to place on abortions, and the first example of that happening since the amendment was passed.
So what about abortion rights groups like Abortion Forward? I mean, what have they said about this bill, other bills?
Yeah. So generally speaking, I think any kind of bill like this, they would view as being a burden that voters rejected. And in particular, they said this bill is basically the same as the one it's replacing. I mean, it is shifting from the physical doctor's visit to a virtual one, but there are still gaps that exist that people might not have internet service. They might have to call off work for a doctor's appointment anyways. So, I mean, people can imagine how it would be different to have to get a virtual appointment versus a physical one. But there's still a burden that exists that somebody would have to go through. And they say that's unconstitutional and voters rejected it.
Okay. And so if this passes the full House, I mean, this is still far from over because it would need to go to the Senate. The governor would need to sign it. I mean, there's lots of steps here, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we'll just sort of see how that whole process plays out. I think it's important to note that, like I said before, the legislature is gearing up to meet. And it's not only, I guess it's the spring break, so it's Easter or what have you, but also the primary election is in May. And this is the last scheduled session before the election. And so this bill will give a bunch of Republican lawmakers the opportunity to say that, you know, we've done something to try to fight abortion, you know, and they can take that to their voters.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And coming up, we're going to talk about the election and that May primary that Andrew just mentioned. And we'll get an update on the governor's race. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking today with Sarah Donaldson of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio. And the Ohio Board of Elections on Friday began sending ballots to military and overseas voters ahead of the Tuesday, May 5th primary election. The outcome will decide the final lineup for the statewide offices, such as governor, the Ohio Supreme Court, and other races in the November election. The last day to register to vote is April 6th,
Early voting here in Ohio starts April 7th. So, Andrew and Sarah, why should Ohioans turn out for this primary? I mean, is civic duty? What are there any big races? I feel like the primary is kind of like getting forgotten about, as usual with primaries.
Yeah, so at the top of the ballot, we don't really have a meaningful primary, and that's usually what, well, I mean, I'll amend that in a second, but in terms of, like, there are some candidates who passed on the race that could have had millions of dollars, and we would have had, you know, a very competitive election like we've seen in years past. Like in 2022, we had five or six Republicans all run for an open U.S. Senate seat, you know, that kind of thing. And those kinds of elections have the opportunity to drive turnout a little bit more. You know, voters, we saw in 2022, again, that we had a fairly interesting Republican primary, and then we had no Democratic, or we had a lower profile Democratic primary that year. And there was a huge drop off in Republican versus Democrat ballots as a result. And so there's nothing like that here in terms of really high profile races. There is a Republican primary between for governor between Vivek Ramaswamy and Casey Putsch, who is a, I guess, like a car YouTuber from the Toledo area. But, you know, Putsch has a following but doesn't really have any resources backing him. So I've kind of not been following that as closely. We do have some down ballot races that are pretty interesting for the true Ohio politics fans. on the Democrat side, for Secretary of State, Allison Russo, who's the outgoing state representative from Upper Arlington. She's a former House Minority Leader, so she led negotiations for Democrats in the Ohio House, is running against Brian Hambly, who is a political newcomer. He's a doctor. I think he's a leukemia doctor from the Cincinnati area. And on the Republican side, Robert Sprague, the current state treasurer, is running against Marshall Stribich, who's a former Army intelligence officer who got really involved with state house stuff because they call themselves elections integrity activists, but it's people who think there's some funny business going on with elections and here are all the new laws we can pass to prevent possible fraud from happening. And then finally, also on the Republican side, for state treasurer, Christina Rogner, a state senator, is running against Jay Edwards, who's a former state representative. And that race is kind of interesting because Vivek Ramaswamy, the governor frontrunner, has endorsed Rogner, while the vice president, J.D. Vance, has endorsed Edwards, as has Bernie Marino, U.S. Senator. So there's kind of like some different Republican factions and different camps on that one, too. But that's kind of the overview. And, you know, you can look, there are state representatives who are up for election all around the state, including in Columbus. But yeah, that's kind of what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, Sarah, how do we, without a big heated race, without a lot of money being thrown around, I mean, how do you get people to turn out for a primary?
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of these candidates are already, obviously, just in the way that they're acting, like looking toward the general election. So even some of the candidates are bypassing the primary mentally. But, you know, I haven't seen like a ton of election ads yet. I know Ramaswamy's camp is running one with his wife. They just had a baby. So, you know, that one I've seen on my television a couple times. But it would be my plug to just say that, you know, every election is important. And like Andrew said, there are some, you know, whether you are voting a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot, because, of course, in Ohio, our primaries are partisan. So you can only vote in the primary of the ballot that you poll, whether that's a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. There are contested primaries. And of course, there are, you know, some interesting state house races as well. I won't get too into the weeds with those. But, you know, there are a couple of races where an incumbent lawmaker is being challenged by someone, some races where the Republican Party is like not chosen to endorse someone who is an incumbent. So, you know, all elections are important. And of course, the people, the more local you get, the more likely that that person has a bigger impact on what your day to day looks like.
Yeah. And I wanted to add, I forgot the Ohio Supreme Court.
There is an interesting primary,
five-way Republican primary for that seat. And it's pretty easy to overlook. Judges are pretty restricted in how they're able to campaign and what they're able to say. And in that race, it's like I said, it's five Republicans running to challenge Democratic Justice Jennifer Bruner in the November election. She does not have a primary, and she's the last statewide elected Democrat to hold office in Ohio. So the Republican primary is neutral in that race. So none of the five candidates in that race have really kind of broken out from the other. So I imagine we'll probably see them spend their last dollar every one of them, you know, the week before the election or so. Mm-hmm. But it's been pretty quiet so far, unless you're attending like Republican Party functions and stuff like that. But I want to make mm-hmm. sure I mention that one.
Yeah. So about 6 weeks away from the election, early voting starts in just a couple of weeks. So we'll probably hear more about this and as it gets a little bit closer. I wanted to pivot, though, to the governor's race. Vivek Ramaswamy made some headlines here. Let's listen to a video that was posted on Threads.
Look at the number of universities in our state. I love universities in Ohio. I want us to have the best universities. But we have too many of them.
Absolutely.
They need to be consolidated. And when you consolidate them, they can actually be centers of excellence who are actually the best in their respective domains instead of trying to create replicas and clones of one another throughout the state.
Now, he's getting some pushback, Sarah, for having said that. Vivek Ramaswamy, Republican candidate for governor, says he also wants to get rid of the state income tax. He basically said if Ohio can put a man on the moon, then we can figure out taxes. So he's saying some things that are making headlines, are controversial. But what do you make of this idea of consolidating colleges? People love their colleges.
Well, I do think it's important to mention, and I did not cover this extensively mm-hmm. like it came across my social media feed, but my understanding is that is an old video. Mm. And, you know, Ramaswamy was on the campaign trail, not just to run for governor, but of course, not so long ago, Ramaswamy was running for president as well. So there are these videos that are cropping up, you know, that maybe Democratic operatives have held on to. I think that, you know, this coming out like right at the start of March Madness, when Ohio like proudly has like multiple of its state universities in the March Madness mm-hmm. tournament. I don't think that timing should be overlooked. But
his campaign posted that video, which is just really funny considering that it's the March Madness of all weeks. So I just wanted to,
his campaign posted that.
Yeah, it was on his Threads account.
So mm-hmm. thank you, Andrew. Because this is, I'm going back to like, there was a video that Acton's campaign posted back in November of Ramaswamy talking about something else with education that they had. Ramaswamy's campaign had then like posted it, and then he was catching some flack, so they like deleted it and then posted it again with that part edited out, but then they forgot to delete it on Threads. So like, this is not the first
time. Well, everyone
time.
Always forgets about
Threads.
Yeah,
we need to just be on Threads. I think
yeah, I guess we all have to be on Threads. But it
with
is...
with like, you know, 10 of our closest friends, that's it. Yeah.
I will say that, you know, Ramaswamy, and this is a general comment, like he hasn't held elected office before. Obviously he was appointed to DOGE, but beyond that, like he would be a first time office holder. And I think, you know, you see this a lot with candidates when they're running for the first time or maybe the second time, where they make comments that haven't maybe been field tested or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there you go. It blows up and people are unhappy about it. People are making jokes about it. He's not the first governor to propose consolidating state yeah. universities. I'm pretty sure Governor John Kasich proposed that at one point, too. But, you know, Ohio takes a lot of pride in its state university system. You know, the reason that we have so many is because of another former governor. So,
I'm not going to deny there are a lot of them. So, I mean, he's not wrong, but we'll see what happens. And then, Andrew, you also said there was some social media traffic over the weekend involving Fox News reacting to it was called Outkick, an Outkick story involving Amy Acton and Donald Trump Jr. What was that all about? Amy, was there was a parody account, not really Amy Acton's account?
Yeah, Outkick, which I'm pretty sure is a vertical of Fox News focused on sports, had a headline, and I just don't have it in front of my face, but it was like Amy Acton's crazy old coronavirus pandemic tweets resurface. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them. They seemed pretty mild to me. Like, it would have been pictures of people tailgating at like a Cleveland Browns game, and Amy Acton one on Twitter was the name of the account, said, please social distance, please wear a mask. I mean, if you kind of put yourself back into that time period, that was sort of like one of the main things that people said on social media at the time, you know, like, so I remember, you know, I read the story and kind of like shook my head about what it said. And then lo and behold, shortly after it published, the article put an editor's note in the top that said that the Acton campaign has informed us after publication that in fact, this was a parody account. And so then that kind of stood for a while. And I'm not exactly sure when they retracted the story fully, but some time passed and the article has now been deleted. And now all we have are the memories and the good times that we had on this.
But Donald Trump Jr. is the one who like kind of got it pushed up to the top, right?
Yeah. Then there's an account called Trump War Room, which is, I guess, like a political account, if you can imagine, like an even more political version of that. It exists to push things like this, and yeah, they pushed it pretty hard on Friday, and then like
Amy Acton on X is just Dr. Amy Acton, not Dr. Amy Acton 1, right?
Right. Yeah. I remember, like, I was looking at that on Friday. I was off, but I follow Amy Acton on X, and she doesn't tweet a lot. She does now that she's running for office, but it's all like vote for Amy Acton, and I met with these union officials in X County and that kind of stuff. She's not, you know, like cracking a cold one and posting about the Cleveland Browns or whatever.
Well, back to speaking of candidates, an attorney general candidate, John, is it Kulwitz? How do you say his name?
That's right, yeah.
Kulwitz. Okay, he's a Democrat. And he filed a complaint with the Ohio Inspector General seeking an investigation into Jobs Ohio, which spent $60,000 on 4 episodes for a podcast called The Call Out. Let's listen to that.
My concern is a concern that's been there from the beginning of Jobs Ohio, when millions and millions of dollars of operations are shrouded in secrecy. That's creates an environment for mischief. I see something like this happening, and it just makes me wonder what else is going on there.
So former OSU President Ted Carter resigned over the use of university resources to support the podcaster and her podcast. But Andrew, the fact that Jobs Ohio planned to spend $60,000 on this podcast, which didn't have many numbers of listeners or followers, now Jobs Ohio is being called into question. Can you give us a little background here? So Jobs Ohio is a private entity, right?
Yeah. So Ohio used to have, and it still sort of does have a, you know, it's like the Ohio Department of Development is what it's actually literally called. But it's just a state agency that is responsible for economic development, including, you know, taking money from the state and awarding it as a subsidy to a company to convince them to build a new office or to keep the one here that they already have and stuff like that. And about 10 or 15 years ago, John Kasich, who's the governor at the time, pushed for legislation that outsourced that government function to this private entity that the state set up and created. And so one of the key things about it at the time was that the funding for it, the state basically promised indefinitely to give profits from the state liquor stores that the state runs. Mm-hmm. So the profits on liquor get diverted to Jobs Ohio to fund it. And basically, Jobs Ohio, like, it involves borrowing a bunch of money and then paying it back over time with, you know, proceeds from liquor sales. And so Jobs Ohio has this giant pot of cash. It kind of gets bigger every year. It's pretty stable, even though, you know, it'll be interesting if people keep drinking less alcohol, if that has, you know, an effect on the state's economic development strategy. But this thing just is out there doing its thing. It subsidized the Intel plant that's coming, maybe, you know, any economic project that you've heard about in Ohio, Jobs Ohio's had a hand in it.
But we can't really know much about how much money goes where because it's private, right?
Yeah, there are disclosure requirements that they put on Jobs Ohio, and so they issue an annual report at the end of every year, and they do say what money goes where. They have to also make some disclosures about what their top paid employees make, but there's a lot of stuff as far as individual expenses like this. We would never have known that they were paying $60,000 for a podcast, except for the fact that it came out as this scandal involving the Ohio State president.
Right. They basically admitted to it because they knew eventually something would come out.
Right. So the big stuff we know about, but like the little things, the day-to-day stuff, we don't.
Well, and it was interesting, though, because over the past week, John Kasich wrote that he called sponsoring that podcast Mission Drift and a weak attempt at involving veterans and workplace issues. And then Attorney General Dave Yost basically said back to the governor, like, I would love to know more about Jobs Ohio. This is your fault, Governor Kasich, right?
Yeah, and that's a concern that people have raised about Jobs Ohio, because like I said, they just kind of had this giant pot of money. I remember when Mike DeWine got elected in 2018, there was some concern around then about like, hey, what's a Jobs Ohio actually doing here? Mm. And so you could see how mission drift might happen. And you could also see how, you know, they've faced at times political criticism. And so this is the kind of thing that opens up for more than that.
All right. We only have 2 minutes left, but I just wanted to touch really quickly on the fact that the governor signed a bill last week to ban ranked choice voting. So Ohio is now the 19th state to forbid this system. So that just means no ranked choice voting, right?
Yeah, if you're not doing it now, you just get used to it.
but no one was really doing it in the state, or they wanted to.
Yeah, there were a handful of communities in the smaller side in the Cleveland Akron area. Like, I think Lakewood is mm-hmm. a Cleveland suburb, was looking at it. Hudson, which is kind of an Akron Cleveland suburb, was looking at it, but they hadn't actually done so. Cleveland Heights is another one. There have been at times talks about maybe trying to put an amendment on the ballot to pass ranked choice voting statewide. That could still supersede something like this. This is a law. That's an amendment that would override it. But, you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on here, but the legislature acted preemptively on it just to make sure it stays that way.
All right. Gone and perhaps forgotten since. All right. Well, we have been talking with we've been having the reporter roundtable here on 89.7 NPR News. And I want to say thank you to Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Happy to do it.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, listen back at WOSU.org/allsides. You can also subscribe to our podcast. Every episode is available for free in our mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.